The two top commanders leading the charge of the EWO campaign are Vice Admiral Richmond Kelly Turner, Commandant Pacific Fleet Amphibious Forces, and Lieutenant General Holland M. Smith, Commanding General of the Fleet Marine Force in charge of ground forces. Last night, they met on the bridge of Admiral Turner's flagship off EWO, and here is their conversation. Admiral Turner speaks first.
To me, the most impressive incident of the whole campaign so far was the raising of the flag on the top of Suribachi Volcano Thursday morning by men of the 28th Marines. It affected me very deeply, and I'm sure but General Smith felt the same way about it. I certainly did. That was the most outstanding feature of our operation so far. Assault and capture that extinct volcano rising 556 feet with sheer cliffs around the south. Its capture was carried out in the face of the most tremendous difficulties, and I'm sure that only men imbued with the high spirit of the offensive, love of country, and esprit de corps could have taken that objective. For my part, General, I hope the American flag always flies there, that it's never allowed to come down. It should fly there also as a permanent memorial to the 28th Marines.
This is Sergeant Dick Mawson, United States Marine Corps Combat Radio Correspondent with the Veteran 4th Division. Sergeant Harvey Williams, our control recording engineer, and I are speaking to you now from the Motoyama Airport number 1 on the island of Iwo Jima, the Suffer Island, after the 4th and 5th Divisions of the United States Marines landed to wrest this island from the Japanese and give Uncle Sam another base only 660 miles from the Japanese mainland itself. The fighting is going on now on a ridge just in front of us. You can probably hear the noise of the shelling in the planes overhead as they drop their bombs, and every once in a while you'll hear them strafe and send rockets down. As we look over on this ridge, the Marines have paths cut up the side of it to the top where the Japs are entrenched. You can probably hear the sound of that rocket barrage went off just then over on the ridge. And there's a scene of violent activity there as these Marines are going up and down that ridge, carrying supplies up to the men in the front lines and bringing casualties back out. And there are casualties, too. There are plenty of them. That's one of the Marine fighter planes just passed overhead. He's on his way back to his base to get a new supply of rockets. I notice he has rocket brackets on, but they are empty. A terrific bombardment just went on over that ridge. You can probably hear those planes strafing over there now. Quite a few planes are circling over that ridge. There's a new flight of about 15 or 20 of them coming in now from the south. And up to now, we haven't had any air opposition whatsoever. There hasn't been a single Japanese plane appear over the island. Swishing sound you heard is the rockets. They're moving. They let those rockets go back quite a ways behind the lines on the Jap emplacements. Put them over the ridge from us, and you can't hear them very well. There go two more planes down. The sound of those motors is too loud for you to hear very much the sound of those rockets. There goes another plane down. Let's see if we can hear it. I imagine you heard that one all right. That was a little bit closer. That landed on this side of the ridge, probably somewhere near the front of the Japanese lines. Plane circles around and goes back off to sea then and makes a wide circle and comes back in again. There are several planes in the sky overhead now, and they all seem to be making runs in. There goes a strafing plane. It got rid of its ammunition, its rounds for that run, and has gone back out to sea, and there goes another rocket plane down. It's interesting to watch these things if you're on the right side of the fence. I wouldn't care to be a Japanese and watching it right now. These planes peel off in the same way as a dive bomber does, heads down directly toward its target. Then under each wing, you see a bright spot of light. And then a trail of fire and smoke comes out the front of the plane, pulls ahead and down into the ground. You hear that terrible rushing, tearing sound as these rockets go down, then a terrific concussion as the rockets explode.
Strangely enough, there's anti-aircraft fire in the air again. There's two black blobs of it. How those gun emplacements can live through all that bombardment is something that's beyond me. They are well dug in, but in caves in the side of these hills. But still, with all that terrific bombardment and with the naval gunfire blowing point blank at those cave openings, it's amazing how at this late date there can still be anti-aircraft emplacements to give trouble to the aviators.
They've been using a lot of white phosphorus bombs on there, and the bomb explodes in a huge puff of white smoke in the air, and from the white smoke, hundreds of fingers of flame shoot out toward the objective.
If
you can appreciate that sort of thing in a setting like this, why, there it is. Personally, we'd rather see it in the newsreel.
Hello, Dick. Hello, Dick. This is Steve. Over. Hello, Dick. Hello, Dick. Hello, Steve. Hello, Steve. This is Dick. Over. Dick, this is Steve. I can't seem to get through to you. I receive you, but I can't seem to put to you. Over. Hello, Steve. You're coming in now. Steve, over. Roger, Dick. Do you know what your situation is up there? We're getting another bad showing. Hello, Steve. Our situation up here is this. They spotted an artillery piece, and we fired into it. With Mitch's tank over here, and my 75 has fouled up completely. I'm sitting here, and I can't contact Gallagher. Over. Roger, Dick. Steve, are you still getting the shell fired? Dick, we have spotted it in those caves up there on the high ground immediately to our front. Over.
Hello, Steve. This is Clifford. Over.
Hello, Tom. Steve, have you made contact with your infantry yet? Over.
Steve, we're up here and can't make it through that damn ravine to our left.
Can you give me some idea where you're at up there? Over.
Roger. We're about at the right-hand corner of the airport, right by those two big flags up there. Over.
Roger. Tom, I'll see what I can do.
Oh. Applejack, this is 8-Ball. Over.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Tom. This is Steve. Over.
Hello, Steve. Hello, Steve. This is Tom. Over.
I just talked to Jumpin' Joe, and he said what he knows, they're supposed to be within 100 yards of the airstrip. Over.
We must be right around up here someplace, Steve. There isn't a hell of a lot of infantry here. You know where that... Those poles are right on the edge of the airstrip, and we're not about 150 to 200 yards away from them. Over. But say, Steve, I can see some infantry now. They're about on... working up toward our left here, and I think we may be able to contact them here in just a few minutes. I'll let you know as soon as we can. Over.
Roger. We're fucking selling the hell out of it. We let them have it every now and then. Go ahead and do your best, Tom.
Oh, Steve, this is Dick. Over.
Hello, Dick. Go ahead, boy. Over.
Say, Steve, how far is Chuck Joe's outfit over here to the right?
Over there.
Over.
Do you mean to your right? Over.
That's right, Steve. To my right here. Over.
Well, Dick, I don't know where you're at, but he's supposed to be bordering the beach for his right boundary. Over.
I see, Steve. I got a pretty good idea where the hell he's at over there. I see men over there in the holes. The way I look at it right now, Steve, we're about, I'd say 300 yards to the right of that cliff line over there. That'll give you a pretty good idea of where the hell I'm located. Over.
I got you, Dick. 300 yards to the right of the cliff line. Over.
That is correct, Steve. And I can't see much fire coming there myself. Although you know how it is inside this damn thing. You can't see very well. And the infantry around here are all in holes. And they're not making no movement yet. Over.
Roger, Dick.
Say, is that all fixing coming yet?
No, it has not, and I'm sure waiting on it here sitting in this hole. Over.
Okay, Steve, when you get out of that hole, you know where the hell I'm at up here. I need to come up here and put this tank back on to fix this damn tank up.
Roger, Dick. We have requested it several times now through battalion. The fire's been pretty heavy down here and a little skeptical on it, but I imagine they're sending her in now.
This is Staff Sergeant Alvin Giuseppe, Jr. We are on one of the runways of Motoyama Airfield No. 1. And all around us is a scene of desolation and death. At the edge of the airfield are revetments in which our troops, our different command posts, have taken sanctuary. They have hidden behind them to keep out of range of the mortars and flying bullets which are coming from just up ahead. The last revetment back houses an aid station. And just in front of the aid station are stretchers on which must be about 50 dead Marines. They are being taken back for burial in our new cemeteries just beginning here. It is a dreadful sight and one which would sober any person seeing it for the first time. These men are lying out in their camouflage ponchos and shelter halves on stretchers. They have been brought back from the front lines, and the aid station men are caring for their remains with very great tenderness. They are being put aboard trucks and recons to be taken back now to the cemeteries. This is a dreadful, desolate, ugly island. The dirt is sort of a grayish, yellowish, volcanic ash, very soft and crumbly. And when you dig a foxhole, the sides keep coming in on you. There is very little vegetation because practically nothing grows here. It has to struggle. It has too great a struggle with the volcanic ash. Now we conclude this description of this little piece of hell on Iwo Jima.
Men in battle come up with some odd supply requirements. Often there's a Red Cross field man nearby who tries to figure out some answer to them. This was the case on Iwo Jima, where Bruce Thomas of the Red Cross had to use all kinds of shortcuts to give the Marines what they wanted. Here he is to tell about a few incidents that took place on Iwo Jima.
I'll bet 9 out of every 10 Marines has a Zippo lighter, including myself. So by D+5, everyone was out of fluid, and they came around to us to see what we could do. Well, that's my job. It's up to me to find substitutes, something neither the Red Cross nor the Marine Corps have what we need. So we find it somewhere, somehow. And on this matter of lighter fluid, I found some high-octane white gasoline. You have to use white gas because leaded gas will clog the lighter. And I obtained 5 precious gallons. We put this up in small brandy bottles that had been tossed aside by the medical corps, and we had quite a monopoly on lighter fluid.
Did you find any Jap equipment you could use?
No, that's all turned over to the military authorities. But I wouldn't use any anyhow. It's too dangerous. A lot of boys have run into booby traps that way.
But the Japs don't use booby traps as much as the Germans, do they?
No, I guess they don't, but they're crazy fighters. You can't predict what they'll do. They'll advance when they haven't a chance. They'll retreat when they don't have to. You just never know. My favorite story of the whole campaign concerns a typical stunt of the Japs. They were shooting off rockets. It was a very strange experience to meet with this kind of Jap stupidity, for you see, we'd be in our foxholes and hear these rockets being fired, and everyone would crouch down thinking it would explode the whole area. Well, nothing happened. We didn't crawl out to see why. We just stayed right in our foxholes. But the next morning, the Marine experts would go out and find that the Japs had fired the propeller part of the bomb and had forgotten to put the head on. There wasn't any explosive in it. And yet, with obvious stupid tricks like these, the Japs are fanatical fighters. They get in their foxholes, and you can't get them out. They fight like mad.
This is Staff Sergeant Alvin Josephi, Jr. We are with a battalion aid station of the 21st Marines, just behind the front lines on Iwo. What is your name, Doctor?
Dr. Harry S. Mustard, Jr.
And where are you from?
325 East 72nd Street, New York City.
Well, Doctor, what was the first thing that happened here that put you on edge?
Oh, when we first came up here, there were shells falling all over the place. Pretty thick fire.
Then you had some real casualties here, didn't you?
We had quite a few of them. Even while in reserve, the regiment, the battalion rather kept on having casualties. Other outfits in our area kept having casualties. But on the hill, just in deaths, and casualties were brought back in for treatment while we were under fire. Had quite a few casualties there.
And you had to take care of those men. And were there any dead men in that?
Yes, quite a few dead men. I think there were 2 in all and several bad casualties. We'll probably die later on.
What's your name and rate?
Thomas J. Kyle, Pharmacist Mate First Class, USN.
And where are you from, Tom?
Rockdale, Texas.
What happened?
Well, when I first noticed, I heard a terrific racket and I saw a lot of debris going high in the air. I thought it was a shell at first, and later they told me it was a mine that just had sacked. It exploded on the airfield. We noticed patients laying out there, all burned, and 3 of us ran across and to get them and bring them back into our aid station.
Well, now, you may not want to say that, but actually going out there to get those men back meant exposing themselves to fire and mortars and all kinds of small arms. But you did bring them back and took care of them. Did you get any rest?
No, we didn't get much rest. Things were happening pretty fast that day around here. We just opened our last can of milk, and shrapnel punctured a hole right near the bottom, and it all drained out on us.
We delay the program schedule for this time to bring you a special news report from Guam. For the first time in this war, a B-29 Superfortress has landed on Iwo Jima. By the sheerest accident, one of the big sky bombers roared down on the tiny island where heavy hand-to-hand fighting is taking place. But now we call in war correspondent John Hooley on Guam. Go ahead, Guam.
This is Guam. Here are two men of a B-29 crew. They're here to tell the hair-raising story of the first superfortress to land on Iwo Jima. On one side of me sits Lieutenant Raymond Fred Malo of Danville, Illinois, and on the other, Sergeant James Cox from Merriam, Kansas. Lieutenant Malo is pilot of the Iwo Weenie, named after the exploit, and Sergeant Cox is her radio operator. The Iwo Weenie landed on Iwo Jima yesterday and took off 4 hours later. The sergeant, by the way, isn't a talkative person, so you're going to have to help out, Fred.
Sure, this is Fred Malo. How about saying hello, Jim?
Hello, everybody. This is Sergeant Cox.
Good start. Now, tell me, how'd you happen to be up over Iwo Jima anyway?
We were returning from Sunday's big strike on Tokyo. Our first mission, by the way. Sergeant Cox and I came out here as part of a crew 2 weeks ago, and this is our first big job.
At first, we knew we couldn't make our base. Was about 360 miles out of Tokyo on the home run. The Bombay doors wouldn't shut after we made the run, and they'd drag so much that we were using up gasoline too fast.
I passed the word to throw out the loose equipment in case we had to make a water landing, so no one would get hurt.
We tossed overboard all flak suits, the camera, and expended all our ammunition to lighten the ship.
I told Cox to use emergency rescue procedure.
But the best I could do was to contact the flight control at Iwo Jima.
And what did they say?
They asked what the trouble was. When I told them we were low on fuel and had jammed the bomb bay doors, they asked us whether we wanted to chance it to land on the strip. Lieutenant Malo told me to say he would try the strip.
You say we didn't want to lose the ship, and after all, a water landing is dangerous.
Well, now we've got you to Iwo Jima.
That's where Lieutenant Malo took over.
We had to make three passes to feel 400 feet to ground from the ground to even get an idea what it would be like.
How much airstrip does a B-29 need?
About twice as much as I could see down there.
But you came down okay.
That's right. Everybody held on tight, and I came in alongside Mount Suribachi. After using up about 600 feet of runway, we touched down. Right away, I put on the hydraulic brakes, and co-pilot Lieutenant Ed Mockler of Park Falls, Wisconsin, pulled on the emergency brakes.
Everything turned out fine?
Oh, sure. We knocked down the wind speed at the end of the runway, but the Iwo Weenie skidded to a stop, and we stayed on the strip.
I hear you made quite a sensation.
You're right. Before we got our breath back, we were surrounded by Marines and construction men. They were lining the field when we came in.
And how long were you on the strip?
About 4 hours. We got off there as soon as we could. So after we borrowed some gas, we decided to try a takeoff.
That was just before dark.
Yes, sir. I gunned the motors. There's a lot of horsepower in four B-29 engines and held the brakes. Then just when I returned over at full power, I let go of the brakes and we started out like a shot. It was like a catapult. We got off all right and flew on down to our base without any trouble.
So you saw Iwo Jima and Tokyo all in one day. And on your first mission, too.
That was exciting enough for 10 missions.
Those Marines up there were swell. And I want to say a word for my crew, too. We couldn't have done it without everybody working in a team.
This is Bud Foster speaking from the flagship of Admiral Kelly Turner off Iwo Jima. After 6 days of touch-and-go situations on this island, the Marines on B-26 seem to have themselves well established and are now launching what may well be the final all-out drive to break the backbone of remaining organized Japanese resistance at the northern end of the island. American confidence that the southern half of the island no longer offers any real threat to their beachhead or invasion vessels offshore has been exemplified as the entire fleet, with but few exceptions, has moved to within a few hundred yards of the shoreline, within easy range of any remaining Jap artillery or mortars in the Suribachi area. Jap anti-aircraft fire brought down one of our Navy planes this morning. Another of less than a half dozen American planes which have fallen victim to the battle. I watched him circle over the center of the island, saw a burst of ACAC, then the engine caught fire, and a long trail of heavy black smoke plumed out as he made his way out to sea to escape falling among our ships offshore. But the pilot must have been hit. Off the northern end of the island, he suddenly went into a dive and plunged into the ocean close to our transport. A big explosion followed. A little smoke and fire for a few minutes was all that marked the watery burial place of those Americans. I thought to myself, General Sherman was certainly a master of understatement. This is Bud Foster speaking for the combined American radio network.
What's been happening since the historic day when the Stars and Stripes were planted on Suribachi? And we hear now from Marine Combat Correspondent Bill Ross with the 3rd Division, speaking near one of the rebuilt airfields on Iwo.
This island during the past month has had its face lifted. Virtually nothing about Iwo remains the same as it was when the Marines landed. Mount Suribachi, the 500 feet high extinct volcano on the southern tip of the island, even it presents a vastly different picture than it did on D-Day and the days immediately following. When the Leathernecks first stormed the almost sheer slopes of the small mountain, nothing but rocky paths led to its summit. Now a modern American road zigzags back and forth to the pinnacle where the Stars and Stripes first were implanted on Iwo Jima. The Japanese, since they owned Iwo, and no one can remember when they didn't, the Japanese hadn't bothered to construct roads to any great degree here. Already, there's a network of miniature American highways that carry the jeeps and trucks and other vehicles almost everywhere they care to go. Most certainly, there were no traffic cops on Iwo when we came ashore, but we have them here now. An MP is situated at virtually every intersection on the island's road network, directing traffic and seeing that the island's 15-mile-an-hour speed limit is observed. Not only has the ownership and management of Iwo Jima changed, but the island itself, and the change is for the better.
You may think you know what Iwo Jima was like, and perhaps you do. For a vivid close-up of several incidents which he witnessed on Iwo, let's hear what Leslie Nichols had to say upon his return to Guam.
Never have I seen life and death in such close embrace as on Iwo Jima. I doubt if there are 10 square feet on the island that have not been soaked with American or Japanese blood. The day before yesterday, I visited several battalions of the 5th Marine Division just behind the front lines. At one point, we had to cross an open field to reach a company which was resting at the base of a low ridge. Unflushed Jap snipers were able to cover this area from positions in caves. Bullets pinged across as we raced for the ridge. I jumped for a dugout and landed in the lap of a Marine. He turned out to be Captain Aram Rajabian. Captain Rajabian led his company in that final push yesterday, and I hope he made out well. His company was going in to relieve another, which had lost 8 successive commanders. A private first class was the 9th to take over. I wanted to meet the private and hear his story. Just then, 2 stretcher bearers sneaked around the ridge and passed us on the way to the first aid station. Someone said to me, "There's your company commander." I stepped up and asked one of the corpsmen how the private was getting along. The stretcher bearer stopped a moment. The corpsman lifted the blanket and said, "He just died." I fell into conversation with one of the wounded lying on the ground. As with nearly all Marines, he was cheerful. No complaints, no whimpering. This corporal was proud of the Japanese flag he had found on D-Day plus 10. He had stuffed it into his shirt front and carried it everywhere. When he fell from a Jap bullet yesterday morning, he had tied the flag around his bare leg, just for safekeeping. But the doctor had to take it off, so the corporal asked me to reach under the blanket for a small gunny sack containing his personal belongings. He wanted me to see his Jap flag. I looked in the sack, but there was no flag. I had to tell him. I searched all around the stretcher. Still no flag. Evidently, it had been stolen. The corporal looked up at me, and there was grief in his eyes. "I killed 3 Japs before I got that flag," he said. "I wanted to give it to my dad to put up on the wall over the fireplace. Now it's gone, and I'm leaving Iwo Jima." He turned his head slightly, and the tears began to flow, and I had to turn my head, too, because I thought I would cry.
Not all the heroes of the Pacific are men. Recently, when Marine Combat Correspondent Sergeant Bill Ross came across 9 new puppies being cared for by the men of the 3rd Marine Division, he inquired further, and he learned that the deceased father had been a hero on Iwo, along with his master. Here is Sergeant Ross with the 3rd Division somewhere in the Pacific.
There's a new family with our outfit today, a family that numbers 9 in all. The father of the clan was a well-known figure in the 3rd Division. I say was a well-known figure because he was killed on Iwo Jima. His name was Rusty, and he was a Marine war dog. The new family is his puppies, which he never saw. Rusty, since his death, has become somewhat of a legend to the men of the 3rd. For among the sulfur caves and rugged hills of northern Iwo, he gave his life in a vain attempt to save the life of his handler. It happened just before the close of the campaign. Rusty and his master, Private First Class Walter Josefek of Detroit, Michigan, were leading a patrol which already had cleaned out 2 small nests of Japs. When they moved in on the third pocket, a heavily defended cave, Marine Joseph Eck was hit by rifle fire and dropped to the ground with a wound in his leg. The Detroit man was unable to move because of the wound and the rough terrain. He called for the other Marines to call the dog to safety, but Rusty refused to leave. He stood his ground between his master and the enemy, snarling defiance at the Japs. The enemy troops in the cave seemed to sense that their time had come, but they were determined to fight to the last. They kept firing at Joseph Eck and the other Marines, and hand grenades became a potent weapon in the skirmish. Joseph Eck and Rusty remained in the hot spot between the battling troops. And when a Jap grenade landed in front of the Detroit man, the dog took the full impact of the blast. Without whimpering, he slumped to the rocky ground next to his master, still between the Marine and the Japs. And there it was that Rusty died on Iwo Jima. Joseph Eck was removed from the area as the other men in the patrol moved forward and wiped out the Japs. He died the next day. I happened on the scene of the fighting just as four Marines were placing the dog's body on a stretcher to carry it to the rear, where Rusty was buried in the 3rd Marine Division's War Dog Cemetery. The Grizzly Leathernecks picked up the dog with the same tender care they would have given a fellow Marine. "He was sure a swell dog," said one Marine, a war-tested veteran, every bit of 19 years old. So goes the story of Rusty, the father of the newest additions to the 3rd Marine Division. 9 tiny Doberman Pinscher puppies destined to be Marine war dogs. Rusty and PFC Joseph Eck were inseparable in life and, in doing the job assigned to them, met death fighting the Japs on Iwo.
We are speaking to you from the summit of Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. Last February 19th, the United States Marines established their beachhead on this grim, cruel, forbidding 8 square mile stretch of volcanic ash and lava island that lies halfway between Saipan and Tokyo. On March 16th last, Fleet Admiral Nimitz announced that organized resistance was over at Iwo Jima. It's dusty here, volcanic earth dust that is on everything and in everything. American trucks, bulldozers, caterpillars, jeeps, every known kind of mechanical earth-moving device is adding more dust. 2 airfields have been put in operation. A few Quonset huts are going up. Acres of what once, a very short time ago, were foxholes are now covered with pup tents. There is no time for amenities or any comforts of life. There are scarcely any trees, just scrub brush that is even more bedraggled than ever as a result of the withering, blistering fighting that went on. And as highlights in the black ash and brown-green brush, trim, white, symmetrical gravestone markers. Row after row of them gleam whitely in the distance. They are the graves of United States fighting men. And in the midst of sacrifice, of life, of the heat of construction, even while B-29s land, there is still potential death around. Not all the Japs on Iwo Jima are dead. Not all its honeycombs of caves have been explored. A sniper's bullet can come pinging out of the night at any moment. But despite all this, the danger, the pressure of work, the lack of things non-fighters would consider necessities of life, even the wisps of steam that drift up through the volcanic ground itself, Iwo Jima is now American territory. And the fact that the island is ours is proven by the American flag that flies from the Central Airport. The Battle of Iwo is won. I return you to Guam.
And that's the situation today at Iwo Jima, our latest conquest. Now for news of progress where today's fighting is, we take you to a spot less than 400 miles from the Japanese mainland. To Okinawa. Go ahead, Okinawa.